The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey, folks, and welcome to Typology, the show on which we explore the story of you through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, your co-host. Thrilled to have you here with us today. We have a great conversation. Big fan of Dr. Scott Lyons. He's a holistic psychologist and educator. He has written a brand new book called Addicted to Drama, Healing Dependency on Crisis and Chaos in Yourself and Others. And we dive into this whole subject of being addicted to drama. It's such a rich conversation. And Dr. Scott Lyons gets under the hood with us. He is an Enneagram 4 Wing 3. He talks about his own addiction to drama and how he came out of it. So rich conversation. Glad you're here. That's it for me, Anthony Skinner. And now here is our host, Ian Cron.
Hello, Typology Tribe, and welcome back to this show on which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. Anthony Skinner, how are you this week?
Woo-woo! I'm doing well, and I'm excited about our guest.
I am, too.
We're in good company today.
We are in great company today. We want to welcome our new friend, Enneagram 4 with a 3-wing, Dr. Scott Lyons, who is also the author of the new wonderful book, Addicted to Drama, Healing Dependency on Crisis and Chaos in Yourself and Others. Dr. Lyons, welcome to Typology.
Thank you guys so much for having me. And I feel, truly in good company with a bunch of fours.
That's right. That's right.
I feel seen and unique at the same time.
Yes.
Such a rare experience for me.
Well, we have time to disappoint you. Trust me.
Thank goodness. I love to be also disappointed.
So I have to laugh because I thought to myself, only an Enneagram 4 could write a book with the title Addicted to Drama, since creating drama is kind of one of our magical gifts, isn't it?
I would say it's our absolute strength.
I would agree. In my book, The Road Back to You, I wrote that Enneagram 4s could turn just a fundamental breakup with a partner into a Wagner opera. That's kind of our deal. This is what we're great at.
What's funny is I used to direct opera, so I love that you just said that. Yeah, it's all coming
That's
home.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. So the title is, self-explanatory, but I want to say that when I picked it up, I thought to myself, this is really interesting because there's no question that I work and am in the recovery space, and I just know, particularly around addicts, how they love to create drama. And I run into people all the time in recovery rooms who talk about, I couldn't live without the adrenaline of drama, et cetera. Tell us what the book is about, though it seems explanatory. I want you to kind of dive a little deeper for us.
All right. Yeah, absolutely. So the book is essentially like, how do we get hooked on stress? Mm-hmm. How are we creating our own suffering in this world? How are we interrupting and preventing our own life of peace? And we all know someone addicted to drama. Like, you ask any person walking on the street, and I'll invite you to do that experiment and just say, hey, do you know anyone in your life who's addicted to drama? And you don't even have to define it. And viscerally, they go, absolutely. And yet there was not a single book, there was no significant research supporting, like, how is there something that we all intrinsically know, but there isn't support and resources and information out there to help us understand what it is that seems to be such a human condition? And so, yeah, it was like, absolutely have to write this book. Also, because, I have been known as a drama dabbler my entire life. And
drama dabbler.
Drama dabbler.
Tasty.
That's a yummy signifier right there. So, Scott, Let's circle back to this Enneagram 4 thing. Sure. So Enneagram 4s are people who have this sense that there is something fundamentally broken, some unnameable piece that's missing in their essential makeup. And in order to compensate for it, they have to be special and unique, which of course is counterproductive, right? It actually prevents them from getting that which they really want, which is a sense of belonging and normalcy in the world. Now, they are known more than any other number. There's one other that could get close, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But we really are known for our draw to drama, right? As a younger man, my word. Tell me about your journey as a four and your experience with drama, the addiction to drama.
Yeah, I mean, I always, and this is characteristic of those who are addicted to drama, like I always felt out of sync with the world. Mm-hmm. And I can, you know, we can explain it from the Enneagram perspective, but I am happy to also explain it, you know, later on in the show about from the nervous system perspective, from the science perspective. But I always felt like I was kind of an alien. And part of it was like I was totally dissociated as a kid. I was navigating so much, you know, generations of trauma and my own actual developmental trauma and traumas I was experiencing as a kid that I vacated myself. Mm. And so I was cut off from myself. I didn't feel like I belonged to me, let alone the world. And I also was told I was special. And, you know, sometimes that meant something very negative in a way of like, you know, I had severe learning disabilities and was told I was special in that way, special out of the norm. And I was also told I was special because I had this very active imagination and could get up in front of hundreds of people and perform as a four-year-old and be in TV shows and commercials and feel really confident. Whereas opposed to my sister, who the moment she would get in front of an audience would freeze and then run into a bathroom and hide there for hours. Mm-hmm. Still does that, bless her heart. So, you know, drama showed up in a lot of ways for me as a kid. Like it was stirring things, creating challenges and issues that didn't need to be there. And they may have seemed kind of innocent. Like I remember speaking to my sister, I remember an incident where she was playing basketball and I really wanted to have her win. So I went and got water from the fountain and spit it onto the basketball floor thinking, oh, the other kids might slip and then my sister will win. And I never understood like why that was an issue because I was supporting my sister. But I was always even stirring things up on the playground, kind of pitting people against each other, gossiping, just also catastrophizing, kind of being ill when I wasn't, or having some type of like even small symptom like a cold and being like, I can't go to school for a week. And my parents, I don't know why, but they put me in theater and dance. Right. I don't know why. Might have been some smart parenting choices. And I was able to take the exaggerated intensification and intensity that I sort of carried around with me everywhere I went and got to funnel it in, kind of put it in a depository that was respected. Now, that doesn't mean I wasn't also doing the same when I was off stage. I just got a place to really be supported in it. And, you know, really good performers will pull you into the world that they're creating and you feel something. Those with an addiction to drama pull you into their crisis, into their vortex of chaos, and you become it. You enmesh with it. It's boundaryless. And so we can see how like there's the strength shadow side there in that same capacity. Now, I'm not saying all actors are addicted to drama, but I'm also not saying they aren't.
So what's interesting here is for Enneagram 4s and people who love them, here's some things to know about this.
Yeah.
Number one, feelings. So we are in the feeling triad, 2s, 3s, and 4s, right? Yeah. They're in that feeling space. 4s are exquisitely attuned to their own feelings, and they have to have big feelings. They can't have little feelings. They have to have like inflated feelings. And when feelings get too small, they have to do things to inflate them.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
We talk about fours having labile mood states, right? So they have feelings that go up and down, and they're big, and it can be very tiring for the people who know them, right?
It's a roller coaster.
It's draining. It can be really annoying that every minute is a drama, right? They're always calling with a new drama, always, you know, and for a lot of different types on the Enneagram, like, this is not awesome. It's like fives can't stand it. Nines, oh, it can be a bit of a burden. You know, eights just think it's too self-indulgent. I can go on and on, right?
Yeah.
But man, we all do know. Anthony, do you know somebody who's a drama addict?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, me too. I got one.
Absolutely.
I got one in my family. Do you? I mean, seriously, you know, I mean, no.
Are you trying to get Anthony in trouble right now?
Absolutely.
Like, does his family listen to this show? I see how you stir the pot. I see you. Number four, drama addict.
See me get some drama going
stirring
right now.
It up, but he's stirring it up.
No, but I think, you know, one of the things is too, is that drama also gives us an inflated sense of our own self-importance, right? Like, if I'm in the middle of a drama, then I'm important. Right. Is that right, Scott?
Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the questions I have often asked the patients I work with who live on the scale of being addicted to drama, that propensity for drama, is what would you do if you were not important? How would you exist if you were not important? And I had no idea. You know, like, Enneagram is something I learned about in college, but something much more I understand now. And it's so interesting that is kind of the question for fours.
Yeah.
It's like, how will you exist? Who are you, essentially, if you're not?
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Important.
Yeah,
this
right.
is great because twos, threes, and fours all struggle with issues around identity.
Yeah.
So we project an image of specialness, of uniqueness, and can be very, well, I don't want to say histrionic because that's very two-ish, right? With these big personalities that are big emotional outsides, but it's the identity piece in the projection of specialness and uniqueness as a way to compensate for the opposite feeling.
For lack, the void.
Yeah, for lack, for deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, what better way than to have special and unique stuff, relationships, stuff going on all the time?
I mean, when we think about importance too, and often someone will say, oh, someone addicted it, they're just to drama wants attention. And they're probably just an exaggerated narcissist. And I think from the outside, I can understand why people perceive that way. Although, sorry, but it's not true. You know, when anyone is cut off from the outside world, they are locked into the prison of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at that as narcissism, but all they have is the faint relationship that they have to themselves. They don't have the sense of interconnection with other people, that sense of belonging. And when you don't have belonging, it's like speaking really as loudly as you can, hoping someone will hear. And, you know, the basis of any addiction is that there is a void that resides, like an emptiness that is within this individual. And we know that emptiness is a reflection of trauma. So we have these variant traumas, developmental, generational, shock traumas. I mean, there's lots of different traumas. I mean, we all have experienced on some level, some variant scale of trauma. Now, what that does is it creates a wound where something gets out, let's say, an opening. And often through that opening, we disassociate, we disconnect. We vacate the place of pain. And another way physiologically we do that is we enclose it. You know, when we have edema, when we have that swelling, it encloses the area of injury to prevent it from further injury. And so there's a way of being imprisoned within yourself or being cut off from yourself. And like all addictions, It is looking at how do we fill the void? How do we prevent further pain? How do we fill the void? And when you have a void, you don't exist. There isn't a sense of existence on this plane. So you fill it with things that give you a sense of aliveness or purpose. And stress is a free, always accessible thing to fill and distract yourself with. Stress gives you a sense of aliveness. It is pure energy. The first stage of stress is called activation. It is energy. Truly, your cells and your hormones creating the amount of energy you need to react in the world. And it releases essentially pain relievers, endorphins into your body. And it's occupying. You also feel sensation when you have stress that's high enough, when you have the emotionality that's high enough. So it fills the void. It distracts from pain. It soothes over some of the pain. It makes you feel alive, like you have some value or some sense of like you exist here. And we could even extend that to, oh, importance. So it's filling all of these voids, all of these shadows, this emptiness.
So I love this. Because I think this is going to be so helpful for Enneagram 4s, and I'm going to get to some other numbers in in a second. But here's the question I'm going to go back to.
Yeah.
Are you a recovering drama addict or a current drama addict? And let's start there. Is that the part of the driver behind or the interest in your writing this book?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely recovering, sometimes still dabbling. Mm-hmm. I think certainly I've done a lot of work on stopping the mechanisms of revving myself up, stirring the pot. Mm-hmm. I've done the underlying work of healing the core wounds. Not to say it's all done, but there's certainly a lot more space in my body that I've been able to come home back to, which is, again, the opposite of the need for an addiction. And I've let go of the identity of being a victim in the world. And that's a big one. And I have done a lot of work to reconnect what was broken, what was ruptured in that sense of connection. I feel belonging in the world. I feel belonging with other people. Mm-hmm. So there's all of these things that I've done that are definitely part of the healing process for an addiction, let alone an addiction for drama, have allowed me to not need it anymore.
So can you articulate what, because I really want fours and others to hear it, because one of the things that people need is to go, oh, so Scott has struggled with this.
Yeah.
And I do, I'm not alone. Can you very briefly tell us, okay, well, what was the core wound for you that led you to have a propensity or a tendency toward creating drama or made you a drama addict?
I mean, I think it was an accumulation of a lot. Like I definitely come from a long lineage of drama addicts, to be clear, but I would also say transgenerational trauma.
Okay.
And I have witnessed them, and it was modeled for me that this is the way that you act in the world, especially because that's the way they had to fight to get attention, to be seen, to be loved. Mm. And so the chaos in my household was a replay, was a replication of all the chaos in my grandparents created and my great grandparents created in their households. So it was the norm. And so, you know, when you grow up in a household of chaos, what are the ways to be seen and heard? What is the currency for love, essentially? And for me, it was if I was funny and provocative, then I would be seen. If I was ill, something was wrong, diseased in some way, I would be seen. Those worked. So that became my currency for love. And let alone my own, you know, navigation of a family that in that chaos, it was hard to predict. It was hard to predict whether there was going to be a hug or a slap, as I talked about in the book. And in that lack of predictability means I never got to really settle. I had to be vigilant to what was coming next. And, you know, there was a serious birth trauma. Like my mom was in the hospital for a long time after I was born. There was a pretty serious injury that she incurred as in giving birth to me, you know, that was certainly not her fault by any means, but there was an absence very early in my life of people being able to attend to me. And they were preoccupied with their own pains and hurts, as most, I mean, as most humans are when they are parents. Just because you become parents doesn't mean you've healed from all your stuff and you suddenly have more energy and attention to disperse to the people who need it. No, you're still struggling with your shit. And so like, I have no anger towards my parents because they were doing the best they could with the resources that they had. And those resources that were different at different times, whether those financial resources or energy resources or time resources. But my overall experience was there wasn't enough for me to feel safe enough to receive them.
Was there a moment that you realized, and maybe I'm getting ahead of where you're going, Ian, but that this isn't working for me?
Oh, yeah. It was this morning. But I don't know, 40 years later. There was a moment. And it's interesting because I, as in my teenage years and as I started doing meditation and yoga, and I was so convinced that I had ascended to this ability to just be able to tolerate so much stress. It was a guru in my mind of like stress. Like I knew how to handle it. And what I didn't really realize was that I was building a tolerance for it. And that's, and for those of you who are familiar with addiction, tolerance is the level where, the stage where essentially you need more to feel more. You need more drugs to get high. You have built a cap. And that's really important to understand the difference between capacity and tolerance. So I could tolerate and needed an enormous amount of stressors to achieve what I have always needed to keep thriving off of stress. I needed it to keep distracting me. I needed it to help numb me. I needed it to help rise above that threshold of numbness so I could feel important and alive in the world. And I needed it as a battery pack to exist. And
interesting.
In my late 20s, I OD'd on stress. I mean, I literally burnt out and I literally died and was, you know, for a few minutes. And I kept accumulating and I was like, oh, and all the time I was like, I can handle this. I can handle this. And at the same time I was saying that I can handle this, I was saying, why me? Why is it always me? Why am I being chased by the stressors and the drama? Like, all I want is peace. I meditate. Clearly, I want peace. And it was the point where I was in my mid-20s. I got in my first relationship ever because I finally found someone dysfunctional enough for me to feel safe with.
Wow.
And who wanted me. And so, like, the combination of the two, I was like, yes, I'll do this. And it was extraordinarily toxic. And every time I broke up with that person, I went back to them. It must have happened 100 times in 4 years. And I couldn't figure out, I'm like, why do I always go back? I don't know. Because I feel bad for them. That was my reasoning. So, late 20s, they broke up with me, which was the first time. And it was like the thing that topped me off. It was literally the thing that helped me overdose on stress. And I ended up developing, I mean, I was also dealing with a bunch of neurological issues. I was dealing with grad school. I was directing one of the biggest rock bands in the world. I was terrified that they would OD. I was like, there were so many factors that I just kept piling on. And people are like, wow, you're so multi-talented. You do so many things, which just fed into my desire, you know, my uniqueness. But really, all the things I could juggle was because I needed more balls to juggle. And when I topped over that line of tolerance into overdose, I just fell, hit rock bottom. I couldn't get out of bed for months. I was throwing up blood. I mean, it was pretty dramatic. Wow. I mean, because I couldn't not do it dramatically too, but it was physiologically, it was very dramatic. And I got to a point where I could function a little bit more. And I definitely did not feel like myself still. And I noticed I started picking fights with my sister and my parents, who literally were bringing me food because I couldn't get out of bed. And I noticed I was more interested in violent movies all of a sudden. And I felt better when I would call my ex. And I was like, what? This doesn't make any sense. Why would I be feeling more like my quote unquote self by going to these things that are clearly negative, these clearly things that are not bringing me to joy and happiness and peace? And that was the moment, or around the moment, when I was like, there's something funky here and I don't want to live my life this way. And I remember telling that to my therapist at the time, and I was like, this doesn't make any sense. Why would I be going towards things that stress me out? Why am I listening to music that makes me sadder when I'm already sad?
Well, because you're an Enneagram 4. That might be one reason.
Because I'm an Enneagram. Well, thank you for explaining now. Where the hell were you 10 years ago, 15 years ago? Doctor. And my therapist at the time, and I was like saying all these things. I was like, you know, like I'm sitting in the bathtub and I just think about my ex. And then I'm like creating stories about a fight we're going to have and we're no longer in a relationship. I was like, this doesn't make sense. And I was like, it doesn't make sense because I have been doing meditation and yoga for years. And she turns to me and she said, meditation and yoga, what a beautiful place to hide. Mm-hmm. And that just ripped the last little shred for me of hiding. Mm. And I felt so exposed and raw. And I needed that. I needed that to start to say, drama and stress are no longer going to be my snack food.
All right. Well, so this is great. I think, Anthony, that I was just thinking about this earlier before the interview. Like, okay, what types would probably be drawn, would be more vulnerable to a drama addiction than other types? And what I came up with is, and okay, get folks, you can email me or text me or DM me what you think of this. But I think the types that are least, first of all, I think any of them could be, but I think those that are more, who are least likely, are ones, threes, fives, and nines. And I think the ones that would be more vulnerable would be twos, fours, sixes, and eights. Okay.
Who are the enablers?
Well, it could be nines and twos, either one, but for very different reasons.
Mm-hmm. So those would be like the martyrs of like, I'm going to go save them, or they're the ones who go like
twos and fours,
people who are like, oh, I'm going to, when they call me and they're venting, I'm going to gossip with them. I'm going to put logs on their fire.
Yeah. Well, that could be a bunch of numbers. I think that's just a human characterological problem, you know? But I do think that, for example, with twos, the helpers, they might be drawn to another person's drama because in that drama, they could be helpful and become someone who could use that as an opportunity to strategically give and meet the needs of the people in the drama in order to win a sense of their own self-esteem, to win approval, to win appreciation, et cetera, et cetera. I'd say that fours, we already know, we've already spoken about it. You know, sixes, because there's so much anxiety in the life of a six, right? They're already living in worst case scenario thinking all the time, right? But also eights but interestingly, sevens and eights would be drawn to drama perhaps because it was exciting. But I don't think, it gets a little trickier with them. They may not have much patience for it. However, I do think there are certain personality styles that are drawn to it, which brings me to one of my last two or three questions.
Sure.
Is everybody a drama addict, or are there just specific, I don't want to say types, but there's a specific subset of the population that you would label or classify as drama addicts?
Well, I would say certainly you and I.
Probably. Not as much, though.
Not as much. We've moved past it.
Well, I'm 62, and I've done a ton of work. Yeah. And I'm a particular kind of four that would be less attracted to drama than what's called a self-preservation four. Social fours would be more likely to be drama
You mean 4.3s?
What's that?
4.3s.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much.
No, I'm a 4.3. That's the wing. But I think it's just a there are some variants in each of these types that I think would also account for different flavors of whether or not they were drawn to drama as an addiction. But so, again, is there a subset or is it everybody?
I think maybe 30, 40 years ago, we would say there's a subset. That those individuals who where the conditions were right, and in my book, I really break down the conditions of what creates that addiction to drama specifically. You know, 30, 40 years ago, I would say less people. And now we're seeing that those same conditions that created that subculture, that subpocket of those who had an addiction or have an addiction to drama is being replicated on a mass scale by social media.
Yeah, because you're being rewarded for it, right?
You're being rewarded for it. The exact same conditions. And this is serious. I mean, because it's like all the world's a stage.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. You know, there are 5 billion people on social media. Do you want to know the emotion that gets the most clicks, likes, and replays? I bet you could guess. Anger.
Sure.
Followed by fear. I mean, so we know these heightened emotions are getting rewarded. And that means that like we have to replicate the conditions to put ourselves there. And we're being overstimulated as the viewers with those particular emotions without necessarily the means to understand what's happening to our physiology or the skills to metabolize it. So we're being overstimulated and underprocessed as a culture.
Wow. This is really powerful, Anthony, and worthy of a longer conversation than we have time for, unfortunately, because, you know, think about, for example, even our political conversation, right? You know, there's always a drama going on. There's always some new...
Well, let me put it this way. Is there a drama or is there an event that's being portrayed with the tools that create more of a sense of drama because that is what gets viewership.
Yes.
You want attention of the people and you want to maintain the attention of viewers. How do you do that? You create and induce a stress response.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are entire PhDs now based on marketing and neuroscience. This is all they focus on is basically the brain chemistry and the pathways to maintain and capture attention. This is it.
I want to go lay down and take a nap right now. I want to go back to my drug of choice and just forget any of this ever happened. Hey, so here's my question for you, Scott. So I'm your client and I want to ask you, okay, man, I'm a drama addict, no question. So how do I move into recovery? Like, how do I find healing? How do I find healing?
Yeah. I'd say like first, wow, that feels so significant that you've been able to identify that. What does it mean for you? I mean, if you're really my client. And then I'd say like, it's more in the moment, and especially when I'm working with someone. So you're telling me a story, for example. So you're telling me a story about that person in your family who's addicted to drama. It's never you. It's that person in your family. It's that friend. It's that your mother-in-law, etc. And I notice you're speeding up. So I'm going to say things like, I'm curious what it might be like to add a little bit of space between your words. And as we find a little bit of space, can we use that space to look underneath the hood and check out what is it that you're feeling? What are some of the feelings that are present in your body? Sensations. Oh, you're coming back to you. Yeah. And how is that as you come back to what's happening in you? And as you lead the story a little bit and attend to yourself, because remember, there's not really an attention to their selves, even though they seem like a narcissist. The attention becomes about the other person, what they did wrong or what they, you know, what's happening out here. So bringing someone back to themselves is fundamental because they have to be home for us to then process the trauma that is the core fuel for the distraction or the survival techniques that they're using, the survival behaviors.
And then I assume you're also by this point, also talking with them about the core wound that is the underlying cause and condition that is fueling whatever the trauma
takes some time. We might not get to it for months because, you know, if you're an expert, I would call it a crisis hopper aficionado, jumping from one thing to the next, never allowing yourself to settle, because we know, you know, those who have an addiction to drama, and all of us can relate to this. You know, if you've ever sat in a bathtub, gone to a meditation class, gone for a walk, and something that's easeful, sitting watching a sunset, and all of a sudden you're thinking about your grocery list, or a fight you had with that person, or what you have to do at work next week. Those ways of like essentially revving yourself out of that settling and ease and quietness and stillness. We all know that. It's just chronic for those with an addiction to drama. So we have to be able to navigate that reflexive response of revving back up. We have to take care of that first, because we can't actually get into the trauma because the safeguard protecting that trauma is this reflex that says, oh, we got to be vigilant. We got to go find things in the room or things in our mind to stress out about to avoid and make contact with the underlying pain and emotions and hurt. So that's why it might take months.
Well, though, I appreciate that. Anthony, I don't think you're a drama addict. No, I don't. I don't think you are. I've known you for years and you don't. That's not your MO. Do you think I'm a drama addict?
I don't think so. I've kind of been processing as we've been going along. Mm. We've been running together for almost 12 years now. But yeah, I would say no. And I think you're right with me. I think there was a time when I was. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, I would say that certainly in my 20s, teens and 20s, and especially when I was in active addiction, chemical addiction, there was. And you know, I meet a lot of chemical addicts that when they get clean, find that they are very drawn to drama.
Yeah.
Because they've been in, there's been chaos and crisis for 10 years, right?
It's the
norm. Oh, great. You know, I lost my wife, my kid, I did this, I did that. You know, I went to jail for 4 times. I got 3 DUIs. It's like, you know, it was like one, they're going from one chaotic episode to another. And then they come into a space of like more calm and peace and predictability and stability. And they're like kind of bored.
Wouldn't mind bored.
Got bored looking for a crisis, you know, and maybe I'll become one.
Yeah. That's also the withdrawal symptoms of addiction drama is like you start to withdraw from some chaos, some stress. And we interpret that as anxiety and boredom.
Wow. Right. I was going to say, one of the things I resonate most with something that Dr. Chip Dodd said was, the confusion between intensity and intimacy. Mm-hmm. I definitely used to confuse intensity with intimacy. And that was one of the things that kind of was the fuel for drama in my world. And understanding that and separating that was like game changer.
Well, when red flags feel like home, you're going to go replicate them. You're going to go seek them. And you're going to be weirded out and frustrated why those red flags are there, even though you were the one that sought and created it. Which is what those who are addicted to drama are doing. Like if the internal world, which is a place of dis-ease, anxiety, unrest, urgency, isn't matching the environment, there isn't a sense of belonging. There isn't a sense of being in sync. So what do to create a sense of belonging in sync? You make the environment and those in it chaotic, be in crisis. Mm-hmm. And that, through drama bonding, is the false sense of belonging.
Okay. So I got an example of this, Anthony.
Yeah, give us an example.
All right. I think, Scott, tell me if this falls into that category.
Yeah.
So I have this person I know. Mm-hmm. And every time, and I've met multiple people like this, every time, this is going to get a little morbid, every time someone dies with whom they had just maybe a passing acquaintance, they suddenly announced that they were best friends with this person, that oh my God, so-and-so has died. It becomes very histrionic, very big. Yep. And oh my gosh, and they're weeping and they're on the phone. Oh my gosh, can you believe it? And then they're rushing over to the family and they're bringing food and flowers. And I'm always like, you barely knew this person. Like, and suddenly you have, and you see this a lot, I hate to say, with, you know, sometimes this happens with teenagers, you know, there's this kind of over the top response, and they were almost my best friend, and you know, they were, you know, but you're like, I don't think so. Like, that's a little kooky the way you're, I mean, it's terrible. Glad you want to be helpful, but you're actually now contributing to, and I've seen this, you're burdening the family actually with your response. And
so there is all the air out of the room. You're vacuuming the space for them to have their own process. Uh-huh. Yeah. I was with someone who, when I had said, we think my mom has cancer, dropped onto the floor, screaming, crying, and talking about how he doesn't know if he can handle, like, if she dies. And I was like, I'm still here. Like, do I get to have an experience too? I guess not. Okay. I'll take care of you. Like I always have. It's a great example. And did you ever see the movie or watch the play Dear Evan Hansen?
Oh no, but I've seen it. I've seen the thumbnail for it on Amazon.
Exactly what happens in Dear Evan Hansen is all of these people suddenly it's their best friend who died. And it's such an impeccable display of addiction to drama.
And you see it all the time on like Instagram or on social media. When somebody dies, suddenly everybody's part of the family. And you're like, wow, that's pretty intense. Like, maybe I'm just an old Irish Catholic guy, but you know, I just can't imagine sharing with the world on Facebook that, you know, my parent died. Or this or that. To me, these are very private, sacred, personal things. And I just feel like advertising, it's like, well, why don't you go buy a billboard? You know, let people know that way. It's like, it seems very strange to me that, and maybe it's just because I'm kind of private and tend to want to process those kinds of things alone. But I actually don't feel like I want to process it with all the strangers that follow me either. So I don't know. It's a crazy world. It's such a rich topic. And I think it's one that's needed, not just for our personal lives, but for our communal lives to be examined. And I want everybody to go out. I want you to get Dr. Scott Lyons' new book. It will, I'm sure, be incredibly enlightening, if not healing. It's titled Addicted to Drama, Healing Codependency on Crisis and Chaos in Yourself and Others. Hey, Scott, tell people how they can learn more about you and the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can check out my website. It's Dr. Scott Lyons, so drscottlyons.com. And there's a quizzes on the website if you want to take quizzes. Am I addicted to drama? Are you addicted to drama? Or do I know someone addicted to drama? There's information about my book there as well. It's on anywhere you can buy a book, as well as other information about things I'm doing are on my website and my wildly spicy podcast that I do called The Gently Used Human with Dr. Nice. Scott Lyons. And I'm also on Instagram and other social media at Dr. Scott Lyons as well.
Some great four pictures on that Dr. Scott Lyons.
Oh, man. I'm looking right now. And Scott's got him some bad pictures, man. He's got some bad headshots on here, doesn't he? He's looking good.
Are you looking very
good? On my Instagram or on my website?
On your website. Hey,
on your website.
Scroll down, Anthony. Look at Addicted to Drama. And look at him. He's sitting on that staircase, looking to his left as though a spy had caught it. Very good. I like this a lot.
I'm glad you got the playfulness of that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, totally.
Provocative snarkiness.
Absolutely.
We got it. This is fantastic. Okay, everybody, go right out. Addicted to Drama, Healing Dependency on Crisis and Chaos in Yourself and Others. It's a book you got to read. Scott, thanks for being with us.
Thank you guys so much. It's been a blast.
Hey, and Typology Tribe, remember these words. May you have love, may you have joy, may you have peace, may you have healing, may you have rest. Until next time.